Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at the world of wildlife in Wisconsin with our two guests, Jamie Knack and David Drake. Jamie, an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. Jamie, welcome back.
Hey, great to be here.
And David is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and also a professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David, good to see you as well.
Nice to see you. This is the first time in over 2 years that the three of us have been together in studio.
In the studio.
It's a monumental day.
Yeah, it is indeed. And of course, we want to hear from you as you listen in. You can join in the conversation. If you got a cool wildlife photo to share, question, or maybe a wildlife experience to share, give a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Ideas@wpr.org. Jamie, let's start with you. Most young wildlife spend most of their day away from their moms. And so in terms of intervening, I've always been of a mind, unless, for example, I see a fawn standing over her dead mother, I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah, this is the time of the year, spring, summer, where families are hopefully out enjoying the outdoors. And it's also the time of the year where wildlife are having their young. And so the chance of having these encounters is certainly increasing. And I think still there's many, many, I'm one of them, that works remotely. So I'm at home more often and am well aware that I've got a nest of house wrens that are going to fledge here any day. Mm-hmm. Just kind of what's going on. So oftentimes people come into contact with a young animal when they don't see the adult nearby of said animal. And, our instinct is to help that poor defenseless animal. And instead of jumping in to help, there's lots of things you can do to kind of observe from the distance or maybe know a little bit more about that species ecology to be reassured that actually what you're seeing is completely normal and there's no need to intervene. And we could talk about a couple of examples. Rabbits will have multiple litters throughout the summer. Oftentimes people interact or find the nest because they're doing yard work. Last summer, yeah, I was adding mulch to some landscaping beds, and sure enough, under a little shrub, I could see some fur and spread it apart, and there was a little nest with baby bunnies in it. And I showed my daughters and talked to them about, mom only comes at dawn, at dusk, maybe through the night. But otherwise, she leaves them alone. They have really large stomachs. They can handle, hold a lot of milk, and They do just fine. Yep. We actually took it a step further. And if this is something you're thinking about doing, I'd encourage you to use caution. But I set up a trail camera on that nest and then checked it after the bunnies were all gone to get the pictures. But that's exactly right. So we have pictures of the mom nursing the bunnies and times where the bunnies were old enough, just ready to kind of be off on their own, maybe softball size, and eyes open, and you'd see them jotting around in the pictures and then all tucked back in, and you wouldn't notice they were even there. So if you come across a bunny nest while you're doing yard work and you're concerned, what you can do is take some grass or maybe some sticks and just lay them across that nest. And then the next day, 24 hours later, go and check and see if that pattern that you laid of grasses has been disturbed. If it's been disturbed, mom's been there, and you can rest assured that you're doing the right thing. Another example, at this time of the year, birds are fledging. So a robin, for example, or these house wrens that I'm talking about, when they hatch, they're still in the nest for 10 to 14 days where mom's feeding them, or both parents in some cases. And then they're old enough to fledge. And when they fledge, they still don't have their feathers completely developed, and they're just learning to fly. So they're around your yard and not strong flyers. And you, again, might think they're injured, something happened to them. But in fact, for the first couple of days, mom will continue to visit them and feed them on the ground as they build up strength to be a strong flyer. That's the time, those couple days, where you want to make sure your pets are contained, because they can be really vulnerable to dogs and cats and other animals. So just a couple of examples of what would be very normal behavior right now. But as Larry mentioned, if you come across a fawn whose mother just got hit by a car, that's a time to intervene. If you see an animal with a broken leg or observing, like circling, you know, foaming at the mouth, things like that, not necessarily you should intervene, but it's time to call a wildlife rehabilitator and get some more advice from an expert.
Yeah, and the wildlife rehabilitators, I know the DNR website has a list.
Yeah, so there's a ton. Like I talked about bunnies and the ecology of fledgling birds a little bit. If you go to the DNR's website and under the keyword search, type in keep wildlife wild, they'll have a list of all sorts of wildlife that we commonly encounter and what their typical ecology is, what's normal, what's not normal. In addition, they have kind of a list of when should you really seek help from a wildlife rehabilitator. And then there's a directory of wildlife rehabilitators in the state that you can call. They would much prefer that you call first. There's also some disease concerns right now with not only COVID, but with avian influenza, where there are certain animals, wildlife species that they're not necessarily taking in depending on the symptoms because they want to be careful to not spread disease with the other animals in the clinic and spread it back to wild animals upon the release. So pay attention to that. And again, always best to observe from a distance, check out that website. And if you have more questions, call a wildlife rehabilitator and get that technical advice over the phone.
And you mentioned avian influenza, and maybe turn to you for a second here, David. There's some news out relating to terns, Caspian tern.
Yeah, so unfortunately, we talked about this earlier in the spring, Larry, about the high pathogenic avian influenza. And there's high pathogenic and low pathogenic, and essentially the difference is how lethal it is to commercial poultry flocks. And right now, we talked earlier in the spring the fact that in Jefferson County, for example, just east of Dane County here, that they had to depopulate a 3 million flock facility. So it seemed to have died down, but all of a sudden now there's news out that the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources biologists and some of their counterparts in Michigan and the United States Fish and Wildlife Service were up on some islands off of Door County and some other islands throughout Lake Michigan monitoring Caspian terns, which is, in Wisconsin, it's a state endangered bird, and Michigan's a state threatened bird. But these are long-distance migratory birds, so they migrate thousands of miles, come up here, nest on these rocky islands, gravelly islands in the Great Lakes. And so as they were monitoring these colonies, as they do annually, they found that they found upwards of 1,500 Caspian terns that were dead from avian influenza. And on top of that, they found many other ones that were suffering from avian influenza that, but hadn't died yet. So, and that 1,500 estimate is, or the 1,500 count of dead Caspian terns is probably a pretty drastic underestimate. Because there are scavengers on these islands, such as raccoons, red fox, you know, gulls, things like that, that will take these dead birds away before the biologists get there, and they may have also died in the water and weren't recovered. So it's estimated in Wisconsin that upwards of 64% of the Caspian terns, the nesting Caspian terns or adult Caspian terns, are dead in Wisconsin from this avian influenza event, and that may have long term repercussions because they're slow reproducers. So not only are you losing the adults for them this year, but you're also losing the reproduction of those adults for this year. And those adults have a lot of imprinting and a lot of experience that they pass on to the younger generation. So there's a lot of concern right now that just from this one event that they may have lost
a generation.
Possibly generation, yeah. So,
wow.
And it was Caspian terns, double-crested cormorants. They found over 1,100 of those dead, American pelicans, some different gull species, things like that. So, yeah, it's very unfortunate and very sad news. And some of the biologists who were up there said it was absolutely devastating day to see the dead ones, but then to see these live ones that were suffering, but you couldn't do anything to help them.
Yeah.
And it sounds like the fact that they're colony nesters, that they're nesting in close proximity, that facilitates the spread through the airborne spread of the disease. So,
Wow. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests, as we take a look at the world of wildlife. There's some kind of sad news there, but there's also good news and sort of in the middle news as well. And maybe you've got a question or a comment or an experience to share, or maybe even a photo. If you got a photo, a wildlife photo, you want to send it in to ideas at WPR.org. Send that in along with a question. Or you can phone us 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Love to have you join in. You know, there are a lot more black bear sightings in the southern part of the state these days, David. And I mean, why are we seeing this kind of migration from the north to the central and south?
Yeah, and this is maybe a good news story to bank on what we just talked about, but. The Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources estimates there's probably at least 24,000 black bears in the state of Wisconsin. And obviously, black bears are a forest associated species, so they like to be in areas where trees are. Obviously, most of the forests are in the northern part of the state, northern half to northern third part of the state. So that's where the bulk of the black bear population exists. With most large predators like black bears, those young males get older, they get pushed out of those breeding territories so that they can't breed with the mom or their siblings. They don't compete with the dominant males, and so they, nature pushes them out of those territories. And at about a year and a half to 2 years old, those young males are on the move. And because they're trying to set up their own territories, but up in the northern part of the state, those territories are already taken because there's so many black bears up there, that they start seeking out new territories, and so they're starting to move south in the state where the black bear population is not that dense. There's also very, very good black bear habitat down here in the southern part of the state because we have remnants of forested areas. We've got areas with a lot of agriculture, a lot of different types of food in urban, more urbanized type areas where black bears can certainly live. And so a lot of the black bears that are pushing south into the southern part of the state are these younger males that are looking for territories to establish their own families. And as they do that, they come into these areas, and these young male black bears are kind of like 16-year-old drivers. They're kind of stupid and inexperienced and don't quite know where they're going. And so they tend to get into a lot of trouble simply because of that. So, and it's not uncommon. We've seen black bears in the southern part of the state for you know, better part of a decade now. As the black bear population up north grows, this is occurring more and more commonly. And we've had them down here in Dane County, and we've had them over in Milwaukee. And now they're in Washington and Waukesha County, which are counties very similar, very close to Milwaukee. And those areas are also very highly populated with human beings. So there's a great opportunity for people to see these black bears. And so they can live down here in the southern part of the state. There's plenty of habitat for them, but they do tend to conflict with our lifestyle, and so the DNR would prefer to keep them up in the northern part of the state if they can.
Yeah, makes good sense. Holly in Rice Lake has a question for us that doesn't relate to bears. We'll get back to bears, but Holly, want to give you a chance. Hi.
Good morning. I am calling from Rice Lake, Wisconsin.
Yes.
And I take my dog out walking on the soccer fields behind my house, and the last couple of mornings she's had a run in with a coyote, and I've decided I need to change my walking patterns because I believe that coyote probably has pups nearby and is defending her area, and I was wondering how long before those pups are grown up enough so that they move on and I can go back to walking my dog back in that corner of the soccer field.
Yeah, sure thing. Thanks so much for the call. Really quick, if you're still on the line, when you say a run-in, could you describe that a little bit more? Was there actually a physical interaction?
Yes, there has. The dog got ahead of me and all of a sudden she'll yelp and come running up to me, and the coyote was right behind her. And as soon as the coyote saw me, it stopped and went back into the cover. And this morning, yeah, she really kind of bowled the dog over. I've got an old dog, so she bowled the dog over, and we limped back to the house.
Okay.
But the coyote actually came out onto the soccer field and kept an eye on both of us until we were quite a ways away.
Yeah. Yeah, so it does sound like perhaps there are pups around, or there's something there that coyote is trying to defend. So a couple of things to do is, obviously, as you mentioned, avoid that area for a while. If you're in that general area, if you see coyotes around, the best thing to do is get your dog on a leash as quickly as you can, so you can control the dog and then move away from that area with the dog, because the coyote is more interested in the dog and sees the dog more as an intruder or a competitor than it does you. So if you can get the dog out of the area, that should relax the situation pretty quickly. The other thing you might want to do is, if you can notify the police department or whatever county you're in, your county biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and just make sure that other people are aware that that coyote is in that area and is acting aggressively, likely, again, because there's a den there, so that other people don't have that kind of encounter. That would be a good public public community thing to do. And then coyotes right now are, you know, the pups were born probably April, May, so they are right now starting to kind of get old enough that they can move away from that den site, and they probably are not tied to that den like they were a month or so ago. So that situation, if the coyote adult is defending the den, that situation should kind of settle down in the next couple of weeks as those coyote pups start getting more mobile and further from the den. And eventually, probably by the end of this month at the latest, they will no longer be using that den. So the situation should settle down. But you should let other people know, especially, I would say, your local police department and the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources County Biologist. Let them know of the situation so they can post a sign in that area or alert the other part of the community that this is going on to avoid any other conflicts.
Yeah, chances are you have a community Facebook page too, yep. And I see those posted occasionally in our community when folks are seeing fox or coyote in backyards, just to you know, raise awareness. Yeah. So
Nextdoor app is another good one to use if you're familiar with that as well.
Holly, thank you so much for calling. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today. Tyler Ditter's our engineer, by the way. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Looking at the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin with our two guests, David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist for the University of Wisconsin. It's great to have both of them here. Questions for them, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. I know I had a couple of other comments on black bears. You know, we did have in May, black bear attacked some people. In fact, jumped right through the window of their cabin, Jamie. And that's something you normally don't see. Now, there was a cub connected with that.
Yeah, so I've seen a couple different. So I guess we should clarify. A cub is born in the den. And so at this time of the year, that cub is like 6 months old. It's maybe 10, 12 pounds at the most. And then a yearling, so sows, their cubs, stay with them for 2 years. So they've got a year where they're a cub and a year where they're a yearling before they get kicked out, as David was talking about earlier. And so sows typically breed every other year if the food sources are available to them and they're in good body condition. This is off track just a little bit, but the other thing... This is breeding season. So David was talking about the sows are pushing out those males. It's also breeding season where males are dispersing south and west in Wisconsin to look for mates. They'll breed now, but they go through what's called delayed implantation. They actually don't start developing until they go into hibernation. And that is an advantage because then the bear can focus on eating all summer and all fall, to put on that weight in the den or before it goes into hibernation. But back to this bear that was in Medford, my understanding is it was a sow that had either a cub or a yearling. Sometimes people mix that up again because they stay with the adults for 2 years. And they had really followed everything we asked them to do. It was at a bird feeder. They opened a window and yelled at the bear, "Hey bear, get out of here, you know, go away." And that bear either got startled or was super protective because of the cub being there, and it came through the window. And I think we all know, you know, some of the struggle, and they ended up killing the bear in their house. But mostly those are some of the things that we tell people to do. One thing you bears in the warmer months, they're after food. They really don't want to have encounters with humans, but it becomes food related, or they're driven by food. So things like bird feeders. We really don't need to be feeding birds and have that spilled bird seed around in the winter. Just stick to feeding orioles and hummingbirds, and you don't need to put out all that seed. There's plenty of natural foods available for birds. So that's a big attractant. Garbage, don't put it out until the day of pickup. That can be really helpful. Secured containers. If you have fish scraps or meat scraps, maybe keep them in the freezer until it's time for the garbage to go out. That can help, again, with the smell. Barbecues. The grills can be an attractant. So, again, keep those maybe inside a garage. Those are all things that can keep bears coming back to see if that food source is there. So, best thing to do, remove the food source, because that is 99% of the time the attractant. And then you have to be a little patient, because they'll still come back and check to see if that food is back. They remember that. So it might take a couple of weeks before you stop seeing them visiting. If you do come in contact with a bear, a black bear, the guidelines are, or the suggestions are, to make yourself big, spread out your arms over your head, talk to the bear. Hey, bear, get out of here, bear. Walk slowly away. Don't turn your back on the bear. Don't run. And don't play dead when it comes to a black bear. Trying to think, are there other...
Well, we should also say that, you know, these stories are headline grabbing because they're spectacular stories, and they get a lot of people's attention. But your chance of encountering a bear and having a negative encounter with a bear is extremely, extremely rare. So we don't want to alarm people, but we certainly want to make people educated as to how to avoid conflicts with bears and be proactive about that. But... yeah, as Jamie said, you know, black bears are relatively docile animals, and they're not like a grizzly bear. They're not terribly aggressive. They don't have very good eyesight, so if you do encounter a bear, they might stand up on their hind legs, and they're trying to get a sense of your smell and see what's out there from the smell. So if they stand up, they look imposing, but they're not necessarily threatening when they stand up. They're just trying to get a better sense about what is in front of them that they can't necessarily see all that well. So... yeah, I think as Jamie said, just, you know, make yourself big, wave your arms, remove yourself from the area, you know, back slowly away. And we should say at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, they have a really good fact sheet on living with black bears in Wisconsin. And if you're interested in that, if you just Google living with black bears in Wisconsin, it should come right up, and then you can read that at your leisure.
Let's take another call. Lillian in Brown County, we go to you now. Hi, Lillian.
My question is about possums. The past 2 years, each year I've seen a pregnant possum, but I never see possum babies. I have seen tails hanging out of a pouch and maybe a little hand coming out of a pouch, but I never see babies. What's their lifestyle after they are unpouched?
Well, that's a good question. So a lot of times what they will do is they will either cling to the mom's belly, or they'll ride on her back for a while. Until they get to be big enough that they can kind of fend for themselves as well. And you know, with a lot of young animals, they'll have, you know, X number of young, but only so many of them make it to adulthood. So one of the reasons you don't see a lot of them is because, you know, they do get killed off relatively quickly, a good number of them. But the other issue is possums a lot of times are also nocturnal animals. They're not out during the day per se. So they're moving around, and they're trying to obviously protect those young to the extent they can. So they're going to stash the young. They're going to move at night when people can't see them, and perhaps predators can't see them as well. They're going to have those young, you know, clinging to their body fur once they do get developed enough to get outside that pouch. And then obviously the young are going to become pretty mobile on their own very quickly, because they need to be able to grow up to adults and become mobile. And the more mobile they are, the safer and more secure the young are. So they're trying to get to that independent mobile stage as possible, as quickly as possible. And once that's the case, then they kind of scatter along with the mom. So if, for example, they hear you come out the back door of your house, they're not going to just stand there and watch you. They're going to kind of scatter for some cover so that you can't see them that easily.
Lillian, thank you so much for calling. Gene in Green Bay, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a mother raccoon and her three adorable babies living under my Four Season room, and I'm very protective of them, and we leave them alone, but I'm wondering, when will they move out?
I'm happy to take that. It's hard to say. Do you have any idea of maybe when they were born? Probably not, yes, for sure.
Yes, I do, because I've been watching them. I sit up at night and watch them come out the hole. Oh. They are probably 12 weeks old.
So I'm just taking a look here at a textbook, but weaning for raccoons typically occurs at 8 to 12 weeks. So they must be very, very close to leaving that area. But, you know, raccoons was one of the species I wanted to talk a little bit about with keeping wildlife wild, is for a couple of reasons. One, they are an animal that gets under a porch or in an attic, and the mother has her young. And there's a couple things to be aware of. One, if you hire somebody like a nuisance control company to come in and trap, you want to make sure that they're taking everybody, that you don't have a situation where they trap the mother and forget that, yeah, they could have young, because you can orphan the kits that way. Or, as the caller did, enjoy the opportunity to have a raccoons raise their young close by and observe them. But another thing that raccoon mothers will do is they will relocate their kits, much like squirrels and other species, if they feel there's danger with that location. And so if you were to, let's say you have raccoons, a litter of raccoons in the attic, if you were to keep the lights on, if you were to play music, maybe leave a shallow dish or an ammonia-soaked rag, that would be enough of a deterrent that hopefully the mother will relocate those kits on her own without having to bring in somebody to do the trapping and potentially orphaning those kits. So great experience for the caller, and I think they're going to be off on their own pretty soon.
There you go, Gene.
One thing I might just add to that is everything Jamie said, I totally agree with. Once they leave that area, you're confident that they're out from underneath your porch. You might want to seal off that area so that other raccoons and future other animals in the future can't get under there. So take some lattice work or chicken wire or some type of barrier that you can put up and make sure that it's secured to the decking of your Four Season porch, and make sure that it's secured to the ground so that animals can't dig under that as well. But you really don't want things under there for a whole variety of reasons. But once they get out of there, I would put some kind of barricade up so in the future years other animals can't get in there.
Yeah, good points. Gene, thank you so much. Sounds like you got a great experience there. Thank you again. You can join in too. Number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. We've got Terry in Melrose up next. Terry, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for being here today.
Sure.
My question is, I have bats that live in my attic of my house, and I know where they're coming in and out, and I could block the hole, but I don't want to block the hole until next fall. And when would be a safe time to block the hole that they'd be gone? Because I know they don't stay there in the winter.
Thanks so much for the call, and thank you very much for your consideration of the bats. So just to back up really quickly, we've got 8 bat species in the state of Wisconsin, 4 of which are state resident species, and those are the 4 that will hibernate throughout the winter. And because those are the hibernating species, they're the ones who are susceptible to white nose syndrome. And because of that white nose syndrome, that insidious fungal disease, the bat populations in the state of Wisconsin are dwindling rather quickly, unfortunately. So all we can do, whatever we can do to promote sustainability of bats is great. And your consideration of not blocking the hole right now is the right choice currently. So from June 1st to August 15th, it is illegal to exclude bats from a structure such as a house or a building, because if you exclude the mom, she can't get back into that structure if she has pups to nurse the pups, and then therefore you are actually causing the death of the pups if the mom can't nurse them. So That's the reason that you're not able to exclude bats from June 1st to August 15th. Come August 16th, if you wanted to put a one-way excluder device up over maybe the last one or two holes, so you would want to go around your building or your house, seal up all the holes about a half of an inch or larger. You can use expanding foam that you'd spray out of can. You can use some sealant, like a caulk sealant. You can use steel wool, whatever you want to do to jam in those holes. And you would seal every possible access points you can find, except for maybe the last one or two. And you can either build what's called a one-way excluding device, or you can purchase them commercially. And if you just Google bat one-way excluding device, you will see what that looks like. So essentially what you're going to do is you're going to put that or construct that over the last one or two access points you leave open. And eventually the bats will go out that one-way excluding device, but they can't come back in. And you'd leave it up for maybe a week to 10 days. After that, you'd take those excluding devices down and then seal those access points just like you sealed all the other ones. In some older structures where maybe a house or a building that's 50 years or older where it's settled and you have a lot of cracks in both the foundation, the eaves, things like that, it gets very difficult to seal off all those points. So then what you're trying to do is make sure that there are no access points from the walls or your attics into the living space, and then you would just allow the bats to live in those attics or in those walls. But after August 15th, you can go ahead and try to exclude the bats from that area.
Good luck, Terry. Thank you so much for calling. Connie in Portage, your turn now. Hi, Connie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, one day I was driving out in the country, and I looked in my rearview mirror, and I saw two little bitty things moving. So I turned the car around, went back, and it was two baby possums. And they couldn't have been over 3 or 4 inches, or maybe 5 inches long would be the longest. So I picked them up and put them in a box of Kleenex, and they went to sleep. And I have all kinds of numbers where you're supposed to call for people to help. And I drove them to Baraboo, and the woman raised them and set them free.
Connie, that's a great success story and very likely an example where you did the right thing. Looking at the DNR's webpage in terms of possum ecology, usually it's about 4 months before they're ready to leave the mother. And they talk a little bit about how long the possum is. So from snout to rear end, not counting the tail, once they get 7 inches or more, it's felt that they can survive and they've kind of dispersed and that they were on they're on their own. You're describing something less than that, and maybe something happened to mother, and scooping them up and calling a wildlife rehabilitator.
Definitely the right thing.
Was the right move. Yeah.
So thank you, Connie. Interesting story. Dan in Poplar, we'll go to you now. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Hey, I got a question for you. There's nothing I can do about it, or probably you guys can do about it. It's there's about a 5-acre pond that adjoins my property back in the woods. It's been there for about, I would say, 50 years. Anyway, the DNR has decided they're going to drain it. It has a man-made dike going around it. So it's about 12 feet deep in the deepest spot, and then it goes to basically a swamp for the rest of it. I'm just wondering what's going to happen to all the fish and turtles and everything that are in that thing once they drain it. Are they going to all die or do they swim down as the pond lowers?
Yeah, if it's a if it's an open pond, which means that there's inlets and outlets, likely they will the fish will keep swimming. The turtles obviously are less of a concern because they're mobile and they can move across land, so they don't necessarily need that water there at that point. Sometimes depending on what's in that pond, the DNR also may do some seine netting where they're going to catch as many fish as they can and then relocate them or transport them somewhere else. Or they may use that net to kind of, if there's an inlet outlet, they might use that net to kind of push those fish toward the outlet of that pond into another water system before they drain that pond. But that might be a good question for your county biologist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources if you want to ask them. I'm sure that they've got a plan for how they're going to handle all that.
Yeah, thank you, Dan, for calling. Appreciate it. Gary emailed a photo of a turtle. He believes it's a northern map turtle. And if so, it's the first time he's seen one in more than 60 years of visiting the Clover Lakes area between Shawano and Clintonville. She's likely on a mission to lay her eggs. This was taken in early June, so she probably wasn't alone.
Yeah, Jamie and I are just looking at this photo. I think we both have kind of a puzzled look on our face. You know, it certainly could be a map turtle. The way the photo is taken, unfortunately, it looks like it doesn't have enough detail to be definitive about that. We think it might be a painted turtle, which is the painted turtles are the most common turtle species here in the state of Wisconsin. And the only reason we're thinking that is because the map turtles have a little bit more contour on their scutes or the shell. And just by sheer numbers, yeah, a painted turtle would be probably a more common choice of that. But let's give you our email, and maybe we can make that available to the person who emailed in. And if you want to send that picture to Jamie and I, we can take a better look at it when we have a little bit more time, and we'll get back to the person with the email with the definitive definition or definitive identification, excuse me. But you're right. In the picture, it's in gravel, and turtles commonly will go into gravel areas such as shoulders of roadways or gravel, you know, shorelines and things like that. They dig a hole, deposit their eggs, and then the mom takes off, and you know, X number of days later, the turtles hatch out and they kind of fend for themselves. So, it's kind of interesting with turtles. Also, the temperature of the nest dictates whether it's likely to be a male or female. So, the warmer that nest is, the more likely you're going to have more females hatching out. The colder it is, the more likely you're going to have more males hatching out.
Very interesting.
I guess just with the picture, we can't see the bottom. So if the person who emailed is listening and they know when they flipped it over or took a look at it that it's got an orange tinge to the bottom, it's definitely a painted turtle. And if not, I think it's very likely a map turtle.
Yeah.
All right. There you go. Jim in New Glarus, your turn. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Good morning. I was wondering, do we have an idea of how many bobcats we have in the southern part of the state? I heard you talking about bears earlier. I live in New Glarus, and I've been getting bobcats on my trail camera. And one photo, I've got two of them together. One's a little bigger than the other one. So I was thinking maybe male and female. But anyway, I was curious if we have an idea how many exist in the southern part of the state.
I'm going with exactly 37,143.
Oh, that's way over.
You think
so? I think statewide, that population estimate statewide is probably in the neighborhood of 4,000 or 5,000. Yeah. Just I'm ballparking it, but with a harvest of 200 or 300 a year, they can be hunted and trapped, and that's a highly permitted, regulated season. You're correct. Typically, they're in northern and central Wisconsin. But as we talked about the black bear, the habitat is really perfect for them. Yeah. They're really in the southwest and central part. I live in Columbia County, and I've got a number of neighbors. And in fact, the property that we deer hunt on, we've been catching a picture of a bobcat every year. So they are certainly around, and they're also breeding in the area. One thing you might want to do is the Department of Natural Resources has this really large study on, it was on white-tailed deer, chronic wasting disease, and predator study. They radio-collared bobcats and coyotes, and we're looking at, to add to the information in terms of how we manage these species, their distribution, and lots of different questions. But that data is starting to be crunched now and being published. And if you go to the DNR's website, and you type in like Southwest Deer Study or even Predator Study, you'll get to those pages and can take a look at what they were doing. But they essentially were trying to radio collar, I believe it was 30 coyote and 30 bobcat each year for a few years in that southwestern part of the state. So there were enough of them, you know, to get them collared. And of course, they utilized volunteer trappers to help them catch them with a foothold and then call the DNR to come in and put a radio collar on them. So we're learning more and more. And the other interesting thing is there's a lot of bobcats south of Wisconsin. So one of the questions is, are we seeing bobcats from Iowa or other southern states coming in to the southern part of Wisconsin, or are we seeing bobcats from northern Wisconsin coming down? And it could be a little bit of both. So
yeah, but the bobcat population is definitely increasing because the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources just increased the harvest rate, 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, to try to sustain or kind of curtail that population growth a little bit. So, and they are stacking up. I mean, they're out in western Dane County pretty heavily. And for some reason, you know, bobcats are an urban adapted species. They're bobcats that live in Phoenix, L.A., Atlanta, Houston. But for some reason, they just do not seem to congregate in urban areas of the Midwestern populated cities. So, yeah.
Yeah, there we go. Interesting, those bobcats. And the whole show is interesting. As a matter of fact, we're talking the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Nack. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Looking at the world of wildlife today, Larry Mueller here with my guests, David Drake, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, and Jamie Nack, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both also in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. So great to have them with us today. And we'll go right back to the phones. Ross in Middleton has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Ross.
Hi, Larry, Jamie, and David. So over in Crawford County, I've got a cold water stream that has trout in it, or at least I thought. So I've had a number of brown trout, and I think I even have brook trout in this little section. But in the last week, I don't always get to the property, but yesterday I walked, and the stretch that I have is I have maybe a half mile, maybe a little less than that, quarter of a mile of a stream that's kind of near the beginning of it, but nevertheless I've always had decent amount of trout in the pools and such like that. And in the last week I've been walking it and I'm not seeing anything at all. We've not had any like major rain events, and they usually can survive those big rainfalls. I'm wondering, is there some kind of behavior? Is there something that maybe I'm just not aware of that, like in the middle of summer, they tend to hide a bit more? I'm just kind of curious because I'm not even seeing minnows.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Has there been any changes to habitat work that's been done on your site or even upstream?
Right. So, no. I mean, we're pretty much almost at the beginning of the stream, and there hasn't been anything. I think there's like a little bit of like what I would call sort of like refuse that sort of piled up, like, you know, like some branches and logs because of stuff that has fallen in. It may be a beaver or whatever, but that, you know, so the water backs up a little bit behind it, but it's still flowing through it.
Yeah.
So, no major.
Yeah, I was thinking more just, you know, like if there were segments that were maybe harvested and you're getting more sunlight into the, you know, the water's warming. But another thing that you might want to try doing is calling the local fisheries biologist. So go to your local DNR office, look for the fisheries biologist, and either send them an email with your observation. They're probably going to be more tuned into what's going on in your local community, and there may very well be something they can point their finger to as to what's going on.
Yeah, two things I might add is, one, you also may have something local going on where you have a predator that's come in, like an otter, for example, or maybe you've had a great blue heron that's come in there, and that's just scared the fish out of your local area, and maybe they're just downstream or upstream to try to avoid that predation. But the other thing is similar. We talk a lot about wildlife trail cameras, but you can get these underwater cameras that you can also mount. And I think they're relatively cheap, so it might be interesting to get a camera and put it in the water, and you actually may see the fish there. They just may not be there at the same time you're there.
Yeah, good things to think about. And how do you find the local DNR specialist?
Yeah, so if you go to the Department of Natural Resources website, they have a staff directory, and you can search by subject area and county. Those would be the two searches I would search under. So select your county and then type in fisheries, and you'll have a list of your fisheries technicians and fisheries biologists. And there could be something, as you kind of alluded to, too, just in the normal biology of trout at this time of the year that makes them a little less sightable.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you very much, Ross, for calling. Good luck. Appreciate it very much. Let's turn to Tom in Ledgeview next. Hi, Tom.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about pelicans. In past years, there's been a large population of pelicans in the lower Green Bay, and this year there's almost nothing. Have they just moved, or is something going on?
Yeah, so it might be that they've moved. Obviously, they're a fish-eating bird, so they have to follow where the fish are. And if the fish are moving in different areas than in past years, that might account for some of what you're seeing. But unfortunately, the other issue is up in that area. Some of the pelicans have suffered from avian influenza, so you may actually be seeing less pelicans because of the die-off of some of those pelicans due to avian influenza.
Oh, that's another possibility for sure. There you go, Tom. Thank you. Tyrone in Milwaukee, we'll go to you next.
Sir, good afternoon, my friend Larry. And good afternoon, or good morning, late morning, early afternoon, whichever one considers. And Dave and, is it Laura? The guest. Dave, Laura, good afternoon to you both. Late morning, early afternoon to you. Milwaukee and surrounding areas as well. Well, very quickly, I know even as I shared with Jill, and Department of Natural Resources, that would be a wonderful entity for us to turn to, because I know when I was cutting about anywhere from 5 to 7 years ago, I had about 5 baby rabbits. I just missed them with the lawnmower, and I as I shared with Jill, I didn't want them harmed or eaten by the falcons or the hawks, you know, because I know that we have some pretty nice size hawks around here, probably more so than falcons, but the hawks, you know, go after the rabbits there. But the Milwaukee Humane Society was no help to me at that point in time. I don't know how they're doing better now. I guess, as Jill said, they probably have so many, but they wouldn't come and take them. You know, I didn't know what kind of milk to give them. They probably didn't have teeth to chew up the grass there, so I put them in a plastic container there, and I pretty much, you know, had to bite the bullet on that one there, because I didn't know what to do with them, you know. And so, but I did the best I could, you know, with my thought process. But as a Cub Scout, you know, I know they say with most wild things, try not touch, because the human scent will keep the mother away. Dad was probably gone for good anyway, but Mom, I don't know if she was coming back or not.
Well, Tyrone, thank you so much for sharing that story. And a couple of things. That is such a common occurrence. Rabbits will just dig a really shallow divot in the lawn, just in the weirdest places. And then just, you know, pull fur from her body and line that nest maybe with some dry grasses and have her young there. So it happens quite a bit where people accidentally mow right over the top of it. You don't even realize it's there. Looking back on it, if those bunnies had their eyes closed or were, you know, it's not like they just scattered all over and you couldn't catch them. In that case, Mom's probably nearby and will continue to feed them. But if they were still to the point where they couldn't move, eyes weren't open, I would have been tempted to put them right back in that divot and put some grass right over the top of them and leave them be. And Mom would most likely come back and take care of them. Again, why the rehabilitator didn't get involved, it may be they felt like maybe that was the right thing to do. But usually us taking them in and trying to give them milk is not going to work. It's not going to work for the animal. And to be honest with you, the law requires that the law gives you 24 hours to take a wild animal that needs help and get it to a licensed rehabilitator. So we legally, you and I, can't have those baby animals. And it's because they have specialized diets. We don't want them to get habituated to humans, and so on. And then I just wanted to address the human scent. It's kind of a wives tale. It's not really true. Like, if you could go get gloves and handle those baby bunnies and put them back in, great. But if you didn't have them or you didn't have the time to do that, using your own hands and putting them in there, or a baby bird or a squirrel that falls out of the nest, if you use your hands and just put that bird back and leave it, the mother will still tend to that. I think it's what we tell our kids to keep them from bothering nests and birds is, don't touch, Mom won't come back. When it's a little far-fetched.
Yeah, and birds don't have a sense of smell can't smell.
And that maternal instinct is so strong to take care of their young.
Right.
They kind of get over it. So
there you go. Thank you so much for that call. Jerry in Prairie du Sac, do you have a quick question for us?
Yes, I've enjoyed hearing about the wildlife. I live in Prairie du Sac, and I have seen beaver twice on the lower Wisconsin River or in this immediate area, and I've also seen some small trees, 1.5, 2 inches diameter along the river that have shows incisor marks where the beavers have been working on them. So I'm curious about the beaver population here in this area, in the southern Wisconsin, and for that matter, in the state in general. How are they doing?
Okay.
Yeah, the beaver population is thriving. You don't have to worry about them a bit. So beavers are the largest rodent in North America, and as with most rodents, they are, can be prolific breeders, and that seems to be the case with the beaver population. So in the southern part of the state, the beaver population is doing quite well, and as a matter of fact, there's active trapping that goes on generally throughout the year, depending on what the situation is. But a lot of times beavers are flooding cropland. They might be flooding forest land or roadways down here in the southern part of the state. Up in the northern part of the state, typically the beaver issue is more that they are damming up cold water trout streams and allowing that water to get too warm for the trout to actually survive. So they are managing beaver for that reason up in the northern part of the state.
And, Jerry, thank you again for calling. And you can join in, too. We'll take a quick look at the news now and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network. But David Drake and Jamie Nack will be with us right up till 12:30. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Or you could email us to ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with our regular guests, Jamie Nack and David Drake. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Jamie's a senior wildlife outreach specialist. David is a wildlife specialist and professor. Both are with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. So, questions for them? Give a call, 800-642-1234, or email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Let's take another call. Yvonne in Lake Geneva up next. Hi, Yvonne. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Can you hear me all right, Larry?
Yeah, I sure can.
Thank you. First of all, I wanted to thank Jamie for the way she's portraying wildlife rehabilitation. I'm a wildlife rehabilitator, and I really appreciate the professional approach because I think we serve such an important part of serving the public. And I wanted to say to the gentleman who found the rabbits that I was sorry he couldn't find help. The rehabilitation community has really been struggling the last couple years with between COVID and avian influenza, but we do want to help whenever we can. And I think it's important for people to understand we're not funded by the state or their taxes. So we're basically private citizens providing a public service.
Long hours, after hours, to care for these animals that need kind of round the clock care. So, thank you for your comments. And I think that's the message: is they're overstressed, as are a lot of people, and probably staff shortages. And I can imagine there's delays in getting the equipment and materials that you might need, and shortages as well. So, another thing you can do to help wildlife is help support your local wildlife rehabilitators, rehabilitation centers.
Yeah, absolutely. And Yvonne, thanks for what you do, and thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Wendy in Monona, we will give you a chance. Thank you for calling.
Hi. So about 3 weeks ago, I came home and to discover that there was a pigeon at our house. Beautiful pigeon, healthy. It has a band on each leg. I did a lot of calling around and research and couldn't really find anybody that would take them on and adopt that were reasonably close. And I was told that it could just be a honing pigeon that just needed a break. And once it was rested up, it would go on its way. Two, that it was a victim of racing abuse. And so he's still around. And we're not sure. I guess my question is, where may he have come from? And what should we do about it? My teens want to adopt them and bring them in the house, but I'm not sure I want to take that responsibility.
Yeah, it's probably not a good idea.
Well, yeah, so that's an interesting issue you just described, and you're probably the first person I've ever heard describe a pigeon as beautiful. Mm-hmm. Most people don't particularly care for them, but I'm assuming with the bands on each leg, it is a homing pigeon, and you know how it has been treated from a welfare standpoint, obviously, is up for speculation. If you can get a look at the band, I don't know if there's numbers on there, but if you have a pair of binoculars or a spotting scope, I might try to get a look at that, and then go online and try to see if you can find either a Pigeon Racing Association local or some kind of an association. But I'm sure that they have these pigeons registered, and you probably could figure out somehow where it came from, who owns it. If you can get a hold of the owner, they probably would be interested in coming and picking the bird up if they're local. But if it's doing well and it sounds like it's been around for a few days at least, that it's probably surviving on its own just fine, especially in the city. There's plenty of resources for the pigeons to eat. I think I wouldn't worry too much about it. I think prior to having your kids adopted and bringing to the house, I would try to figure out who might own it and see if you can get it back to the rightful owner first.
Yeah, there you go, Wendy. Thank you for calling. David in Twin Lakes. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi there. Yeah, I'm calling because I heard David mention that birds can't smell. And I know as an educator, my fraud course business, I talk about most birds can't smell except for vultures. And David Allen Sibley has now said that research is pointing that they definitely can smell. So I want to know clarification there.
Yeah, so you're right. Vultures, so the reason I say that is because they don't typically have a very well-developed olfactory gland in most birds, with the exception of like storm petrels, for example, or an example of that. Vultures can smell, have a relatively well-developed sense of smell. But for the most part, birds don't have a developed sense of smell similar to a mammal. And maybe I should have made that clarification, but and it's simply because that olfactory gland is just not developed enough for a proper sense of smell, similar to what we think of in mammals.
Ah, there we go. Thank you, David. Appreciate it. Ivy in Evansville, your turn. Hi, Ivy.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up how complex things can be in making decisions about wildlife. I was observing two cranes and their colt, and the parents fed the baby voles. Both parents had captured voles at the same time and brought them over to the baby and offered them to him. And, you know, you hear so much about cranes eating the corn seed and stuff like that, but think about how much corn a vole can eat, and you know it reproduces all year long. And then the other one was tent caterpillars in the fall webworms. I watched a female goldfinch collect the webbing for a nest while the male sang above her, and that was pretty neat. And you know, really the tent caterpillars didn't do it. I mean, the webworms didn't do any real damage. Some people view it as ugly, and I just look at it as, you know, you don't know how it fits in with everything else and what other creatures use it. And what makes me, I think about these things when I think about rattlesnakes and how many rodents they eat and how that affects the grasslands in the West and prairie dogs excavating the soil and how that affects the aeration of the soil and the amount of water that's retained in the soil. Things are more complex than just what we view as the damage they cause to us or how they affect us.
Yeah, thank you for those comments. It's really great, you know, things that you're observing there and kind of connecting. And the more time we spend in nature, the more times we see something we never realized happened, or it breaks the mold of what we were taught or what we thought was, you know, happening, whether an animal was a carnivore and now you see it eating plants or berries or vice versa. I always think about species like the brown-headed cowbird. It's a native species, and yet, you know, it's a nest parasite. So it does have implications to our, you know, other songbirds. But what a what a cool ecological story to evolve with bison and be kind of nomadic and dump their eggs in other birds' nests, and they're not able to stay and incubate, so they move on. And, you know, just all these great stories of wildlife and their interconnectedness. So thank you for sharing yours.
Mm-hmm. Appreciate it very much. Georgiana in Milwaukee, we'll go to you next. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
I had a comment about the homing pigeons, and I hope the lady is still listening. The homing pigeon that she's observing is probably very, very easy to pick up. They're very used to being handled, and she should put it in a pet carrier and start feeding it. It's not going to do well on its own. It's used to being raised by humans, so it's going to be a very easy victim to cats, dogs, other predators. And then to look at the number exactly, the numbers on the legs, and when you type those in, the area or the racer's name will come up, and you'll contact them, and in most cases they will come in and pick up the bird.
And so in the short time, are you suggesting maybe crack corn and some water?
Yes, yeah, definitely. Just, you know, bird seed, bird food, definitely in water. And it will be very happy in a pet carrier lined with paper towel and such, and keep that clean.
Well, thank you very much for your connections there, so we can inform others when we get those calls.
Yeah, thank you so much, Georgiana. Appreciate it. Steve in Hartford, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Hi, can you hear me all right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm on a cell phone, so I might cut out. I'm up in northern Wisconsin. Just real quick, if the experts on board today could give us a little update on the status of the moose in Wisconsin. Every year you see a few of them, and is there actually a small resident group or a transient group or anything they could give us on an update on moose in the northern half of the state?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, they are a native species of Wisconsin, but they are not a sustained population in Wisconsin. So any moose that we have are coming into the state from likely Minnesota, potentially Michigan. But, we have obviously moose don't observe these kind of artificial political boundaries we've put up, such as state lines, so they'll come into the state, but we don't have a sustainable population of moose in the state like Minnesota does, for example.
Yeah, but there aren't, so there really are none.
Well, at this there current time, there could be a handful. I mean, I don't know that they put numbers on them, maybe less than a hundred, a couple dozen.
Yeah.
I see reports, like in Boulder Junction, there seems to be some hotbeds where... Yeah.
They'll come
Wisconsin.
In, but you know they're transient, obviously, so they don't stay here, and there's not a breeding population of moose in the state of Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Steve, thanks again. Michael in Spring Green, your turn. Hi, Michael.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just curious, you know, with all the fires that have been happening out in the western part of the United States over the last 5 years, I'm sure there must be some animal migration, and I wonder is there any way of tracking what's happened to all the animals that were in these horrendous fires in the western part of our country?
Unfortunately, a lot of this would not be good news to report, I don't think.
Yeah, I think it depends on the species. So, you know, unless there's some study going on that is just an independent study, independent of the fire, and because the fire is a random event, you don't know on any given year where a fire is going to occur. But if there's some kind of a study going on where some researchers are putting radio tracking devices on an animal or on individuals of a population, and they have the ability then to track that population's movement as the fire progresses, that would be about the potential or the opportunity to track those types of animals. You know, animals, depending, again, on the severity of the fire, the intensity of the fire, how fast it moves, obviously, the more mobile you are as an animal, the better chance you have to get out of the way of that fire. Animals that are less mobile, such as small mammals, snakes, you know, birds that might be in a nest, those obviously are going to be susceptible to the fire, and it is not going to be good news there, obviously. And you know, these wildfires we see are not good for the ecosystem because they just burn so intensely and they burn so much out of control. relative to a prescribed fire. But on the backside of these fires, it does reduce the amount of fuel that's on the ground. It does promote really good growth post-fire. And so there is a lot of good that can come out of these fires, even though it's very destructive both to human life, it's destructive to the economics of property damage, and it can be destructive to local wildlife populations.
Yeah, I was just going to add that every state agency in the West, they tend to be game and fish departments rather than Department of Natural Resources like they are here. They do annual surveys for certain groups of species, and so there might be an annual survey for deer or songbirds, or we do turkeys and rough grouse and things like that. So you might see in these long-term surveys where you can detect a population change as, potentially as a result of a fire that went through. But otherwise, we don't track individual animals. Right. But the surveys, if they have annual repeating surveys, might pick up some of that loss.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Michael, thanks. Appreciate the call. Doug in Colfax, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi. Thanks for the great show, as usual. A few years ago, I saw a grouse following a deer like it was its mother. I swear it was just a few paces yeah. behind it, and I found it kind of amusing, and I saw it several times, and I'm wondering, is that a case of imprinting? And if so, you explain that a little bit.
It would not necessarily be a case of imprinting. So imprinting is typically where, a young animal, and typically, I forgot the name of the famous German animal behaviorist, it was Franz somebody, but he did all these imprinting studies with geese and got actually young geese to imprint on him. So imprinting really is about that young animal, and it can occur, but I'm guessing what's going on instead is that the rough grouse is following the deer because the deer is probably kicking up some kind of an insect or is disturbing an area that the rough grouse is taking advantage of from a resource exploitation standpoint.
And the two species really don't have any conflict, really.
No,
like they're not
no
afraid of each other. I mean,
yeah.
It's really common to see deer and turkeys right next to each other.
Yeah.
So I agree. It might be they might be taking advantage of the insects the deer are kicking up.
So and the other thing is there are the strange grouse. We had a guy who was every time he started his riding lawnmower, the grouse came
yeah.
over and landed on
right.
his shoulder.
There are some great stories
yeah.
that
great
capture that.
Great stories like that. Is that. Occasionally you get a kind of a rewired grouse.
Right? Follows them around and spends
yeah.
a day in the woods with them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so there can be some of that as well. We've got a bunch of email questions I wanted to get to as well. Somebody wondered where he could see eagles at this time of the year.
Well, at this time of the year, they're pretty widely distributed. So they concentrate in January and February along the open rivers. So they really need open water bodies to find fish to eat, but also they'll feed on carrion. So a for sure time to see them is when they're concentrated and we have a lot of bald eagle watching festivities at that time of the year. But at this time, I would say any of your northern lakes, looking at big white pines on the tops of big white pines, and then just driving. Take
yeah.
Highway 51 and drive north and look for them soaring in the sky. Large bird, and they don't have the turkey vultures have like an upright, they make a V with their wings. You can usually tell the eagles apart pretty easily. So
yeah, eagles have they're just big, long, flat
yep,
planks.
Flat. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the wings. And I would say anywhere in the state for the most part,
yeah.
Yeah. every single eagle territory that's available is filled up in the
yep.
state. So I don't think you have to even go into the northern part of the state. If you just, I would go right now around a water body,
yeah. big
a yep. big lake, a big river, something like that, and just kind of keep your eyes open. The other thing you might want to think about doing is going on your local eBird list and seeing if birders are reporting bald eagles in your area, and then go to that general area.
Yeah, just type in eBird.
Yep, eBird.org, get to Wisconsin, and then you can search by species,
yep.
and it'll show you hot spots. It'll be like a hot spot map.
Yep.
So the darker the color, the more frequently people are seeing bald mm-hmm. eagles in that area.
Somebody wondered if white nose syndrome in bats is related to avian flu.
Not that we're aware of.
Yeah, I haven't seen anything.
The answer is no, but again, science may dictate that differently in the future, but current evidence is no.
Emily and Wanakee emailed, they have had two fox with mange, or seen them, as it makes for a strange-looking creature. The fox has absolutely no fur. You can hardly tell it's a fox without the fluffy tail. She checked the Dane County Humane Society, and they did rehabilitate one of the foxes. She thinks they'll treat the second one if they can trap it.
Yeah, unfortunately, mange seems to be pretty prevalent, at least here in Dane County this year, amongst the fox population. And there's different types of mange, but the most common one is sarcoptic mange, which is created by a mite, M-I-T-E, an ectoparasite that gets under the skin of the animal. And it's not just on fox, but it can be raccoons and coyotes and other fur-bearing animals. And it really is an awful thing. So unfortunately, for mange to be treated, the animal has to be held, and then they offer a number of treatments over a 2 or 3 week period. So the best thing to do is call a licensed wildlife rehabilitator. And in Dane County, it's the Dane County Wildlife Rehabilitation Center, which is associated with the Dane County Humane Society.
The DNR has some efforts to monitor elks, and how do people help with that?
Yeah, so I know we've talked about Snapshot Wisconsin on the program before, which is a collaborative volunteer effort led by the DNR and many other partners to put trail cameras throughout the state and monitor them with the use of volunteers to help us gain information on many different wildlife species. We talked about the bobcat and the bear kind of shifting south and west in the state. Right now, the state is really in need of volunteers to help monitor cameras that they're really interested in the elk information. So cameras in the Flambeau River State Forest and the Clam Lake area. If you would be interested in hosting a camera, you simply go online, complete an application. You need to have a computer and an ability to download photos. They'll provide the camera. There's no cost to you. And essentially, within every 90 days, you go and grab that media card, download the photo, upload the photos into their program. And if you're not interested in monitoring a camera or hosting a camera that you kind of take responsibility for, you can also help the DNR by categorizing the pictures that are taken. So they're collecting millions of pictures across the state. Yeah. And so you can go into a program called Zooniverse, and you can help identify the wildlife in those photos. And they need volunteers to do that. It's actually been a neat activity. A number of classrooms across the state have adopted Snapshot, either a camera or helping with these identifications in the classroom. And the other thing then is you can sign up for a newsletter if you want to hear more about Snapshot Wisconsin. There's a lot of data coming in now, so they have this dashboard, and you could click on any given species, so black bear, and you could see the distribution and kind of, again, a heat map of black bear distributions across the state. So check it out, Snapshot Wisconsin.
Nice way to end the program. Thank you both very much for being with us. We'll look forward to your next visit in a couple of months.
Thank you, Larry.
Sounds great. Thanks, Larry.
Thanks so much. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests today from UW Extension and from the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison. A fun show for you tomorrow as well. Music lover Tom Wilmoth is back with an amazing list of summertime tunes that we'll get to listen to. Hope you can join us for that from 11 to 12:30 tomorrow. In the meantime, thanks for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.